the time and the place.
As our first story begins, in 1803, Washington was no more than a raw country village. In the unfinished capital sat the Senate of the United States, already vastly different from that very first Senate which had sat in the old New York City Hall in 1789, and even more different from the body originally planned by the makers of the Constitution in 1787. The Founding Fathers' concept of the Senate, in contrast to the House, was of a body which would not be subject to constituent pressures. Each state, regardless of size and population, was to have the same number of senators.
Senators were not to be elected by popular vote. The state legislatures, which could be relied upon to represent the conservative property interests of each state, were assigned that function. In this way, said Delegate John Dickinson to the Constitutional Convention, the Senate would consist of the most distinguished characters, distinguished for their rank in life and their weight of property, and bearing as strong a likeness to the British House of Lords as possible. Moreover, the Senate was to be less of a legislative body, where heated debates on vital issues would be followed anxiously by the public, and more of an executive council, passing on appointments and treaties and generally advising the president without public galleries or even a journal of its own proceedings. The original 22 United States senators meeting in New York in 1789 at first seemed to fulfill the expectations of the makers of the Constitution. The Senate, as compared with the House of Representatives, was on the whole far more pompous and formal, its chambers far more elaborate, and its members far more concerned with the elegance of dress and social rank. Although senators were paid in the munificent sum of $6 per day, and their privileges included the use of great silver snuff boxes on the Senate floor, the aristocratic manners which had characterized the first Senate were strangely out of place when the struggling hamlet of Washington became the capital city in 1800, for its rugged surroundings contrasted sharply with those enjoyed at the temporary capitals in New York and Philadelphia. John Quincy Adams noted in his diary that some of his colleagues' speeches were so wild and so bluntly expressed as to be explained only by recognizing that the member was inflamed by drink. But certainly the Senate retained greater dignity than the House, where members might sit with hat on head and feet on desk, watching John Randolph of Roanoke stride in wearing silver spurs, followed by a foxhound which slept beneath his desk, and calling to the doorkeeper for more liquor as he launched vicious attacks upon his opponents. Nevertheless, the House, still small enough to be a truly deliberative body, overshadowed the Senate in terms of political power during the first three decades of our government. But as the Senate shed its role as executive council and entered on a more equal basis with the House into the legislative process, it also became apparent that no constitutional safeguards, however nobly created, could prevent political and constituent pressures from entering deliberations. It was a time of change in the Senate, in the concept of our government, in the growth of the two-party system, in the spread of democracy to the farm and the frontier and in the United States of America. Men who were flexible, men who could move with or ride over the changing currents of public opinion, men who sought their glory in the dignity of the Senate rather than its legislative accomplishments, these were the men for such times. But young John Quincy Adams of Massachusetts was not such a man. John Quincy Adams. The young senator from Massachusetts stirred restlessly in his chair as the debate droned on. The half-filled Senate chamber fairly echoed with the shouting of his Massachusetts colleague, Senator Pickering, who was denouncing President Jefferson's trade embargo of 1807 for what seemed like the 100th time. Sorting the mail from Massachusetts, which lay in disarray on his desk, John Quincy Adams found his eye caught by an envelope with no return address. Inside was a single sheet of fine linen paper, and the senator grimly read its anonymous message a second time before crumpling letter and envelope into the basket by his desk. "Lucifer, son of the morning, how thou hast fallen! We hope not irrevocably. O Adams, remember who thou art. Return to Massachusetts. Return to thy country. Assist not in its destruction. Consider the consequences. Awake. Arouse in time. A Federalist." A Federalist? Adams mused bitterly over the word. Was he not the son of the last Federalist president? Had he not served Federalist administrations in the diplomatic service abroad? Had he not been elected as a Federalist to the Massachusetts legislature and then to the United States Senate? Now, simply because he had placed national interest before party and section, the Federalists had deserted him. Yes, he thought, I did not desert them, as they charge. It is they who have deserted me. My political prospects are declining, he wrote in his diary that night, and as my term of service draws near its close, I am constantly approaching to the certainty of being restored to the situation of a private citizen. For this event, however, I hope to have my mind sufficiently prepared. In the meantime, I implore that Spirit from whom every good and perfect gift descends to enable me to render essential service to my country, and that I may never be governed in my public conduct by any consideration other than that of my duty. These are not merely the sentiments of a courageous senator, they are also the words of a Puritan statesman. For John Quincy Adams was one of the great representatives of that extraordinary breed who have left a memorable imprint upon our government and our way of life. Harsh and intractable, the Puritan gave meaning, consistency, and character to the early days of the American Republic. His somber sense of responsibility towards his Creator, he carried into every phase of his daily life. He believed that man was made in the image of God, and thus he believed him equal to the extraordinary demands of self-government. The Puritan loved liberty, and he loved the law. He had a genius for determining the precise point where the rights of the state and the rights of the individual could be reconciled. In John Quincy Adams, these very characteristics were unhappily out of tune with the party intrigues and political passions of the day. Long before he had even entered the Senate, he had noted in his diary the dangers that confronted a Puritan entering politics. "I feel strong temptation to plunge into political controversy," he had written. "But a politician in this country must be a man of a party. I would fain be the man of my whole country." Few, if any, Americans have been born with the advantages of John Quincy Adams, a famous name, a brilliant father who labored unceasingly to develop his son's natural talents, and an extraordinary mother. Indeed, he was born with everything to make for a happy and successful life, except for those qualities that bring peace of mind. In spite of a life of extraordinary achievement, he was gnawed constantly by a sense of inadequacy, a frustration, a failure. Though his hard New England conscience and his remarkable talents drove him steadily along a road of unparalleled success, he had from the beginning an almost morbid sense of constant failure. Having served as a United States Senator, Harvard professor, and American minister to major European powers, he could write sadly in his diary, "I am 45 years old. 2/3 of a long life have passed, and I have done nothing to distinguish it by usefulness to my country and to mankind. Passions, indolence, weakness, and infirmities have sometimes made me swerve from my better knowledge of right and almost constantly paralyzed my efforts of good." And finally, at age 70, having distinguished himself as a brilliant Secretary of State, an independent president, and an eloquent member of Congress, he was to record somberly that his whole life had been a succession of disappointments. "I can scarcely recollect a single instance of success in anything that I have ever undertook." Yet the lifetime which was so bitterly deprecated by its own principle has never been paralleled in American history. John Quincy Adams, until his death at 80 in the Capitol, held more important offices and participated in more important events than anyone in the history of our nation. He figured, in one capacity or another, in the American Revolution, the War of 1812, and the prelude to the Civil War. Though one of the most talented men ever to serve his nation, he had few of the personal characteristics which ordinarily give color and charms to personality. But there is a fascination and nobility in this picture of a man judging himself more severely than his most bitter enemies judged him, and constantly driven onward by his conscience and his deeply felt obligation to be worthy of his parents, their example, and their precepts. It is significant to note that the two Adamses, father and son, were the only presidents not elected for a second term in the first 50 years of our nation's history. Yet their failures, if they can be called failures, were the result of their own undeviating devotion to what they considered to be the public interest and the result of the inability of their contemporaries to match the high standards of honor and rectitude that they brought to public life. The story of the son is not wholly separable from the story of the father, for John Quincy Adams was, as Samuel Eliot Morison has described him, above all an Adams, and his heartwarming devotion to his father and the latter's steadfast loyalty to his son, regardless of political embarrassment, offer a single ray of warmth in that otherwise hard, cold existence. As a child in a tightly knit Puritan family, John Quincy had been taught by his mother to emulate his famous father, and as a senator, when colleagues and friends deserted him on every side, it was to his father that he turned for support and approval. The failure of John Quincy Adams to recognize the political facts of life first became apparent during his years in the Senate, years which were neither the most productive of his life nor those in which his contribution was especially significant. Yet his single term in the United States Senate gives us a clear insight into the fate of a man who brought to the public service notable faculties, a respected name, and a singular ambition for the right. His experience illustrates, as does almost none other, that even this extraordinary equipment is not enough to succeed in American political life. It was not unnatural that John Quincy, returning to Boston after diplomatic service abroad upon his father's defeat for president by Thomas Jefferson, should become active in the affairs of his father's party. He admired the Federalists as the founders of the Constitution and a bulwark against French revolutionary influences. The young ex-diplomat was elected as a Federalist to the Massachusetts legislature. But while with one hand the legislature moved young John Quincy nearer his vision of service to the nation, with the other it rudely ripped through the fabric of his dreams and placed real and unpleasant obstacles in his path. For the jealous and antagonistic Timothy Pickering, who had been dismissed as Secretary of State by his father, was selected as Adams' senatorial colleague to fill a short-term vacancy. Neither Pickering nor Adams entertain any illusions about the former's bitter enmity towards the entire Adams family. As a well-known and powerful Federalist, Senator Pickering would be able to channel upon his young colleague all the dislikes and suspicions which the remaining Federalist senators had harbored for the independence showed by the senior Adams as president. Nor could he expect sympathy from Jefferson's Republican senators, who had recently completed a bitter campaign against his father and the alien and sedition laws which bore his approval, noting in his diary that the qualities of mind most peculiarly called for are firmness, perseverance, patience, coolness, and forbearance. John Quincy Adams, like any other Puritan gentleman, set out for Washington determined to meet the standards of self-discipline which he had imposed upon himself. Arriving in Washington, Adams promptly indicated his disregard for both party affiliations and customary freshman reticence. Although illness in the family had prevented him from arriving in time to vote on ratification of President Jefferson's treaty for the purchase of the Louisiana Territory, he promptly aroused a storm of controversy by becoming the only Federalist to support that precedent-shattering acquisition actively on the floor, and to vote for an $11 million appropriation to effectuate it. His democratic principles also caused him to fight administration measures for imposing a government and taxes upon the residents of the territory, thus incurring the opposition of his Republican colleagues as well. But with a vision of an America stretched to its continental limits, he regarded Jefferson's remarkable feat in excluding Napoleon from our boundaries while enriching our nation as far more important than the outraged astonishment of his Federalist colleagues. Concerned primarily with maintaining the hegemony of New England, they feared westward expansion would diminish the political and economic influence of the commercial cities of the Northeast, lower the value of eastern lands in which they were financially interested, and provide the Jeffersonians with a permanent majority in Congress. The young Federalist from Massachusetts, as though he were oblivious to their attitude, heaped fuel upon the fires of Federalist rage by attending a banquet of Jeffersonians in celebration of the purchase. This was regarded by his Federalist friends as the final proof of perfidy, for there was only one Federalist politician whose opinions young John Quincy valued above his own, John Adams. Anxiously, he sought his father's views, and the reassurance he received from that elder statesman early in 1804 compensated for all the abuse he had received at the hands of his father's party. "I do not disapprove of your conduct in the business of Louisiana," John Adams wrote his son. "I think you have been right." John Quincy became increasingly contemptuous of the Federalist Party. He could not yield his devotion to the national interest for the narrowly partisan, parochial, and pro-British outlook which dominated New England's first political party. He wrote his mother that he felt that, "If Federalism consists in looking to the British Navy as the only palladium of our liberty, I must be a political heretic. Many senators before and after 1804 have combated the ill effects of being termed a political heretic by their party chieftains by building strong personal popularity among their constituents, but not John Quincy Adams. His guiding star was the principle of Puritan statesmanship his father had laid down many years before. The magistrate is the servant, not of his own desires, not even of the people, but of his God. We would admire the courage and determination of John Quincy Adams if he served in the Senate today, but I am not so certain that we would like him as a person, and it is apparent that many of his colleagues on both sides of the aisle did not. His isolation from either political party and the antagonisms which he aroused practically nullified the impact of his own independent and scholarly propositions. In 1807, the split between party and senator became irreparable, and Adams was denounced by the great majority of his constituents as well as the party chiefs. The final break, naturally enough, concerned this nation's foreign policy. As our relations with Great Britain worsened, our ships were seized, our cargoes were confiscated, and our seamen were impressed by British cruisers and compelled to serve as alleged British subjects in the King's Navy. Thousands of American seamen were taken on an organized basis, ships were lost at sea for want of men, and even those who were able to prove American citizenship were frequently refused permission to return. Adams was indignant that the very Federalist merchants whose ships were attacked had decided that appeasement of Great Britain was the only answer to their problems. His Federalist colleagues even attempted to rationalize such aggressive measures by talking vaguely of Britain's difficulties in her war with France and our friendly tone toward the latter. With undisguised contempt for this attitude, Adams in 1806 had introduced and pushed to passage, successfully, a unique experience for him, he noted in his diary, a series of resolutions condemning British aggressions upon American ships. The Federalists, of course, had solidly opposed his measures. He was now, for all practical purposes, a man without a party. Finally, in the summer of 1807, the American frigate Chesapeake was summarily fired upon off the Virginia Capes by the British man-of-war Leopard, and the American vessel had refused to hand over four seamen whom the English claimed to be British subjects. Several of the American crew were killed or injured. The incensed Adams pleaded with local Federalist officials to call a town meeting in Boston to protest the incident. Turned down, he discovered to his grim satisfaction that the Republican Party was organizing a similar mass meeting to be held at the State House that very week. The Federalist repertory warned the faithful that no just or honorable man should attend the meeting. But John Quincy Adams did attend, and, although he declined to serve as moderator, he nevertheless was instrumental in drafting the group's fighting resolution, which pledged to the president the lives and fortunes of the participants in support of any measures, however serious. Now the Federalists were outraged. Although they hurriedly called an official town meeting to pledge hypocritically their support to the president too, they stated publicly that John Quincy Adams, for his public association with the Republican meetings and causes, should no longer be considered as having any communion with the party. It was this episode, the senator later commented, which alienated me from that day and forever from the councils of the Federalist Party. When Jefferson called upon Congress to retaliate against the British by enacting an embargo effectively shutting off all further international trade, a measure apparently ruinous to Massachusetts, the leading commercial state in the nation, it was John Quincy Adams of Massachusetts who rose on the Senate floor and called for referral of the measure to a select committee, who was appointed chairman of the committee, and who reported both the embargo bill and a bill of his own preventing British vessels from entering American waters. "This measure will cost you and me our seats," young Adams remarked to a colleague, "but private interests must not be put in opposition to public good." His words were unerringly prophetic. As the embargo bill, with his help, became law, a storm of protest arose in Massachusetts, reminiscent of the days of the Boston Tea Party. In that state were located a substantial proportion of America's merchant fleet and practically all of the shipbuilding and fishing industries. The embargo completely idled the shipbuilding industry, destroyed the shipping trade, and tied up the fishing vessels, and stagnation, bankruptcy, distress, and migration from the territory became common. Neither merchants nor seamen could be convinced that the act was for their own good. Even the farmers of New England found their products a glut on the market, their export outlets having been closed. The Federalist leaders insisted the embargo was an attempt by Jefferson to ruin New England prosperity. The Federalist Party, scoring heavily on the issue, returned triumphantly to power in both houses of the Massachusetts legislature. Talk of New England seceding became commonplace. But however great their hatred for Jefferson and his embargo, Massachusetts Federalists, merchants, and other citizens were even more bitter over the desertion of their senator to the ranks of the enemy. Adams' own social circles in Boston, the rich, the cultivated, and the influential, all turned against him. John Quincy Adams was alone, but not quite alone. "Most completely was I deserted by my friends in Boston and in the state legislature," he wrote his mother. "I can never be sufficiently grateful to Providence that my father and my mother did not join in this general desertion. But the entire Adams family was damned in the eyes of the ex-president's former supporters by his son's act of courage." With his father's support, in a fight where he stood with the president who had defeated his father, John Quincy maintained the unflinching and inflexible bearing which became his Puritan ancestry. The Federalist legislature convened at the end of May 1808 with, as the Massachusetts Republican governor wrote Jefferson, but one principal object, the political and even the personal destruction of John Quincy Adams. As soon as both houses had organized, the legislature immediately elected Adams' successor, 9 months prior to the expiration of his term. And as its next order of business, the legislature promptly passed resolutions instructing its senators to urge repeal of the embargo. Only one course was conscientiously open to him. He resigned his seat in the Senate in order to defend the policies of the man who had driven his father from the presidency. He wrote, "Far from regretting any one of those acts for which I have suffered, I would do them over again, were they now to be done, at the hazard of 10 times as much slander, unpopularity, and displacement." Hated by the Federalists and suspected by the Republicans, John Quincy Adams returned to private life. His star was soon to rise again, but he never forgot this incident or abandoned his courage of conscience. Legend has it that during Adams' politically independent term as president, in response to the presidential toast, "May he strike confusion to his foes," Daniel Webster dryly commented, "as he has already done to his friends." Soon after his retirement from the White House in 1829, Adams was asked by the voters of the Plymouth District to represent them in Congress. He agreed to accept the post if elected. But he specified, first, that he should never be expected to promote himself as a candidate and ask for votes, and secondly, that he would pursue a course in Congress completely independent of the party and people who elected him. On this basis, Adams was elected by an overwhelming vote and served in the House until his death. Here he wrote perhaps the brightest chapter of his history. For as old man eloquent, he devoted his remarkable prestige and tireless energies to the struggle against slavery. To be returned on this independent basis to the Congress from which he had departed so ignominiously 22 years earlier was a deeply moving experience for the courageous ex-senator. "I'm a member-elect of the 22nd Congress," he recorded with pride in his diary. "No election or appointment conferred upon me ever gave me so much pleasure. My election as President of the United States was not half so gratifying to my inmost soul." The time and the place. Great crises produce great men and great deeds of courage. This country has known no greater crisis than that which culminated in the fratricidal war between North and South in 1861. Thus, without intending to slight other periods of American history, no work of this nature could overlook 3 acts of outstanding political courage which occurred in the fateful decade before the Civil War. In 2 cases, involving Senators Sam Houston of Texas and Thomas Hart Benton of Missouri, both of whom had enjoyed political dominion in their states for many years, defeat was their reward. In the 3rd, that involving Daniel Webster of Massachusetts, even death, which came within 2 years of his great decision, did not halt the calumnies heaped upon him by his enemies. It is not surprising that this 10-year period of recurring crises should have brought forth the best as it did the worst in our political leaders. All in a position of responsibility were obliged to decide between maintaining their loyalty to the nation or to their state and region.
For many on both sides, the decision came easily. But to those who felt a dual loyalty to their state and their country, the decision was agonizing. The cockpit in which this struggle between North and South was fought was the chamber of the United States Senate. The South, faced with the steadily growing population of the North as reflected in increasing majorities in the House of Representatives, realized that its sole hope of maintaining its power and prestige lay in the Senate. It was for this reason that the admission of new states into the Union, which threatened continuously to upset the precarious balance of power between the free and the slave states, between the agricultural and manufacturing regions, was at the heart of some of the great Senate debates in the first half of the 19th century. By 1850, vast new territories acquired by the Mexican War accelerated the pace of the slavery controversy. The attention of the nation was focused on the Senate, and focused especially on the three most gifted parliamentary leaders in American history, Clay, Calhoun, and Webster. Henry Clay of Kentucky, bold, autocratic, and magnetic, reveled in a love for life, and had a matchless gift for winning and holding the hearts of his fellow countrymen and women. Elected to the Senate when still below the constitutional age of 30, he was subsequently sent to the House, where, in a move never duplicated before or since, he was immediately elected Speaker at the age of 35. Henry Clay had visions of a greater America, and so in 1820, 1833, and 1850, he initiated, hammered and charmed through reluctant Congresses, the three great compromises that preserved the Union until 1861, by which time the strength of the North was such that the secession was doomed to failure. John C. Calhoun of South Carolina, with bristling hair and eyes that burned like heavy coals, had a mind that was cold, narrow, concentrated, and powerful. Strangely enough, although he had the appearance, especially in his later days, of a fanatic, he was a man of infinite charm and personality. Calhoun believed that the geography and climate of the Western country made it unlikely that slavery could ever prosper in many of the territories that were seeking to become states, and that only in the Southwest could they hope to balance the surging tide of free Western states by securing new slave states and senators from the land seized from Mexico. The Clay Compromise of 1850, which sought to conciliate the differences between North and South as to the ultimate fate of these lands, thus assumed far-reaching importance. All of the currents of conflict and disunion, of growth and decline, of strength and weakness came to a climax in 1850. The three chief protagonists in the Washington drama of 1850 had been colleagues in Congress as far back as 1813. Then they were young, full of pride and passion and hope, and the world lay waiting before them. Now, nearly 40 years later in the sunset of their lives, for they would all be dead within 2 years, with youth and illusions gone, they moved once again to the center of the stage. But they were not alone in the struggle. Neither Senator Thomas Hart Benton nor Sam Houston was dwarfed by the towering reputations of his three colleagues. Each was a legend in his own lifetime, and occupying respectively the strategic